Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll get a first-hand and fresh look into 9/11, the War on Terror, and Al-Qaeda. We are joined by Ali Soufan, the author of a new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. Ali Soufan is a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. We'll explore in depth the issues of torture, strategy, and political cover-up with this important insider who will fill in some holes in the insufficient public knowledge available in regard to these momentous events that have shaped the last decade and continue to dominate our lives. Then we'll be joined by Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He has just met with top officials of the IMF, who are concerned that the global economy is in dangerous territory as a European debt crisis threatens to drag us into a deeper recession or even a depression. We'll find out what measures might be taken to reverse the drift and calm the markets. Joining us now is Ali Soufan, who is a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. He has been profiled in The New Yorker and has been featured in books, newspapers, articles, and documentaries across the globe. He is the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Soufan.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
And the story begins, of course, in 1979, at least in terms of Al-Qaeda. That was a very key year, given the peace deal between Israel and Egypt, which incensed the Islamist, the number two guy being Ayman al-Zawahiri and Khattab, and where the inspiration for Al-Qaeda began in Egypt. Then you had, of course, the fall of the Shah, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. But a very important incident that you mention in your book, Ali Soufan, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, was the incident at the Holiest Shrine of Islam in Mecca. Tell us why that was so significant, the taking of the mosque.
Well, there was always a tension in Saudi Arabia between the government and between the extremist elements of the Wahhabi sect of Islam. And the Wahhabi radicals were actually essential part of the King Abdulaziz army, who established the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and unified Hijaz and Najd and created the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, after all, became kind of like trying to introduce the modern things to the kingdom, and that created a lot of problems between the more traditional elements. Eventually, this clash took a place in November of 1979 when radical Wahhabis took hostage the mosque in Mecca, which is the holiest shrine of Islam. And the Saudis then realized that they have a big problem on their hand with extremists and with the radical elements that wanted to topple the regime of the House of Saud. December of 1979 came as a gift from heaven to the Saudis, where they basically convinced a lot of these radicals that instead of fighting the Islamic King of Saudi Arabia, why don't you go to Afghanistan and fight Soviets? And they became one of the biggest sponsors of the Mujahideen and of recruiting many of the radicals in Saudi Arabia to go to Afghanistan. And bin Laden was a product of this program to get rid of the problem and export it somewhere else. And how a lot of these events that took place prior to 9/11 resulted in the unfortunate and tragic attack that took place on Tuesday, September 11, 2001, and resulted in the death of 2,977 people.
And, of course, on the following day, September the 12th, you were handed the secret file that you'd been asking for months. And had you gotten that file, you believe that with the information in that file, you could have prevented 9/11. But in many ways, of course, a lot of people, and I've spoken a number of times to Mike Scheuer about it, and recently with Glenn Carl and others who have been involved in this, in what's been called the War on Terror. If you go back to Sudan, apparently he was certainly on the U.S.'s radar then, bin Laden. I understand that, you
know. Absolutely.
And Billy War, the guy that ran the CIA's paramilitary, he apparently wanted to take care of bin Laden and throw his body over the wall of the Iranian embassy there. So what prevented the earliest, when he was really much more vulnerable, if you will, in Sudan, what prevented the U.S. from nabbing him then?
We didn't have people paying attention to bin Laden at the strategic level in Washington. This is, a threat, yes, but, we don't see how the threat is impacting us. This is basically what people in Washington were thinking. You know, the guy, when he was in Sudan, still allegedly never attacked the U.S., and you don't want to do preventive, attack against him. People didn't want it, you know how it is in Washington. People have a lot of problems to deal with. And if you come with them with a problem that didn't happen yet and say, hey, this is going to happen, let's disrupt it, nobody's going to listen to you. But definitely, at that point, the Saudis wanted to deal with that problem because for them, he's a little bit scary. They don't want what happened in November of 1979 to keep repeating itself. And but also at the same time, bin Laden in Afghanistan, he reestablished again the golden chain, which is the money flow that sustained the Mujahideen in Afghanistan during the Soviet jihad. And many of these contacts he still have the popularity. And there's a lot of support that he have in the Arabian Peninsula, and especially in Saudi Arabia, from sheikhs and from religious scholars and from very wealthy people who basically believe in his ideas and believe in what he's trying to do, and they funded his operation for a long period of time, and some continue to fund Al Qaeda.
Well, the first time that the U.S. went after him was when President Clinton fired the cruise missiles at his training camps after
sure.
the bombing of
yes.
the embassies. And, of course, that was at a time when Clinton was beset by problems to do with Monica Lewinsky, and he was accused of distracting the public with this. But bin Laden himself has thanked the Pakistanis for tipping him off, didn't it, that the cruise missiles were coming?
Well, there was a lot of information at the time that he was, he had been tipped off. You're correct. And I think at the time, unfortunately, that became a political issue and a partisan issue. So now if you talk about the threat of bin Laden, some people were telling you, it's wagging the dog, this is because of Monica Lewinsky. Unfortunately, it wasn't because of Monica Lewinsky. There was a threat, and two of our embassies were blown up in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi. So this is, unfortunately, how sometimes domestic politics stand in the way of carrying out what's best for the national security of the United States.
So let's move forward a little bit and not keep beating the dead horse about how many times we could have got him. But clearly that is
many, many times.
that's what haunts you. And just in terms of your story, in the context of what we're talking about, when did you get teamed up with John O'Neill, who was this fascinating guy that was the number one FBI agent in terms of his understanding of Al Qaeda? He was kind of a Cassandra who unfortunately wasn't listened to. And, of course, tragically and ironically, he took a job after he quit the FBI to head up security at the World Trade Center and died on 9/11.
John was a phenomenal figure. And early on, when I was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York, I met John. And I was very intimidated the first time I met him. I mean, he's a character bigger than life. He's known as a legend in the FBI. He was the special agent in charge of the National Security Division. And I was at the time a new agent, a rookie, who had some ideas about terrorism, about, Islamic extremism, about bin Laden. And I was so lucky that John actually gave me the opportunity and took me under his wing. And I learned tremendously from him. Unfortunately, as you said, the person who was leading the hunt on Osama bin Laden, the person who was trying to wake everyone up in Washington and say, listen, this person is for real, and he is going to attack. The big one is coming. Nobody would listen to, died on the day of September 11 in the World Trade Center.
But Ali Soufan, what must have surely burned you and burned John O'Neill was that at the time of the Cole bombing, the Bush administration refused to say that al-Qaeda was behind the Cole bombing. And
absolutely. I mean, we had, first of all, the bombing happened on October of 2000. On October 12 of 2000. And then after that, we had everybody in Washington was busy with the election. And then we had a problem between, the whole thing between Bush versus Gore and, the fiasco that took place at that time. And after that, it was very clear that, unfortunately, the administration at the time did not want, the call to be involved in the U.S. Bin Laden, did not want Bin Laden to be involved in the call attack. And we saw that firsthand. And then later on, even in the 9/11 commission, people from the administration called the cold case stale, and that's why they didn't want to respond to the attack on the USS Cole.
But what is the logic behind President Bush not wanting to risk political capital by telling the American people that what was obvious, which was that bin Laden was a serial killer, he struck at the embassies, and now he'd struck at the USS Cole? Because this leads directly to questions about the Bush administration's their attitude to all the information that was passed on to them by the Clinton people. Many people say that that the Bush people were governed by ABC, anything but Clinton, that they just simply wouldn't.
I think you hit it. You had a bullseye here. I mean, first of all, anything that's coming from the Clinton administration was not considered as legitimate. Remember, and this is also part of the 9/11 Commission, so we can talk about it now, that the Attorney General at the time did not believe that there is a threat called terrorism, and they cut the terrorism budget of the FBI. So they didn't want it to deal with the whole issue of terrorism. After all, terrorism is wag the dog of Clinton because he want to cover his thing with Monica Lewinsky, as you correctly mentioned before. So that's basically one of the things that was going on at the time. We were not able to convince people of the threat of terrorism and the threat of bin Laden and that how serious that is. Another thing that we heard of, and I talk about in the book, is basically, the president was considered a weak president. The country was not unified behind him. And if we announced that bin Laden was behind the call, then he has to respond. And by responding, he has to go to Afghanistan. He has to do some military actions. And at the time, they thought that, since the country is not unified behind him, that can create a lot of problems. So that's one of the reasons that they did not want it to respond to the call.
So what was in that file that made you realize, my God, if I had this information, we could have acted on it?
Right. I think it was, information that we've been asking for since November of 2000. During the call investigation, one of the people, one of Al-Qaeda terrorists involved in the call, told us about a meeting that took place in Southeast Asia. And we requested information from everyone in the government if anyone knows anything about that specific meeting. And then, you know, we continued to basically follow leads on our own as part of the call investigation, and we got more and more information regarding the meeting. We've been told that there's nothing going on. Nobody is aware of anything's going on about that specific meeting. On September 12th, we were told that, you know, that two people who were involved in that meeting were on Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon. And we were giving surveillance photos that was taken in January of 2000. Around the millennium, of people who were involved in that alleged meeting in Southeast Asia that we've been asking about for month and month. If we were giving that information, I believe September 11 could have been a different day. And it's not only me who said that. I mean, if you look at the commission, the 9/11 commission report, one of the very first findings they have is if the CIA had passed the information regarding the Malaysia meeting to the FBI team investigating the USS Cole, they mention the Cole by name. They mention our team by name. You know, a lot of things could have happened early on to disrupt the plot of 9/11. Also, the CIA's own inspector general regarding 9/11, which... you know, their executive summary has been also declassified. It basically came to the same findings and, you know, came to the same conclusion by saying that they did not pass the information on a timely basis to the FBI, nor to the State Department, nor to the Immigration and Naturalization Services, nor bothered to put these people on a no-fly list. So this is what I did in the book is I presented the facts. I presented the facts as they happen. So people, when they read it, they know why the 9/11 Commission reached to that conclusion. They know why the CIA IG reached to that conclusion. I put faces to that story and how 9/11 could have been possibly stopped.
Again, I'm speaking with Ali Soufran, who's a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against al-Qaeda. He is the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against al-Qaeda. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Ali Soufran.
Tall buildings shake, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs. Tuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Don't cry.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm speaking with Ali Soufran, who's a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against al-Qaeda. He's the author of the new book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against al-Qaeda. So, Ali Soufran, what have you come to conclude about why the information about the two hijackers down in San Diego was withheld, and the latest stuff that's coming out now that Senator Graham is asking for inquiries into, that there were some Saudis down there that were helping the hijackers down in Florida as well. There's two possibilities: either these people were working for al-Qaeda in terms of the Saudis, or there's that the Saudis were trying to turn these people or that the CIA was trying to turn these people.
I think this 9/11 is a very important period of our history. And what I decided to do when I took that mission of writing the book is to stick to the fact and to present the fact of what I know happened in that period of time. I mean, there's a lot of analysis from people who are way higher than me, like Mr. Clark, Senator Graham. Those people had a lot more access to information than me, and they are coming to conclusions. I decided not to come to my personal conclusions. I have my personal conclusions. I have my personal ideas of what possibly happened. But I don't know. I will be saying just assumptions.
So,
what I wanted to do, because this is part of history, I wanted to do it like an FBI agent will do it. You know, an FBI agent, we were taught, you only present the facts. Don't put your own assumptions in the middle of the facts.
Right.
And this is such an important period of our history. 9/11 changed the world, my friend. Not only the United States, changed the world. And I think I don't want to make a political stand, a partisan stand. I don't want to come to assumptions that maybe I'm wrong and right. mix it to the facts of what happened. So what I decided to do in this is just tell the American people and tell the world, these are the facts.
Right.
You know, these things went through government approval process. It have been verified. And
so,
readers can make up their minds regarding the facts and can get to conclusions. And hopefully somebody else tomorrow will write a book similar to mine, putting their facts as they saw it. And then we can start connecting the dots and see exactly what happened. But until today, 10 years after the 9/11 Commission, after the CIAIG, I personally do not believe we have an answer yet.
Sure.
Well, you
can understand why I'm asking, and
no,
your,
absolutely.
And your book
I,
is
I
full
agree
of
with you.
Book is full of redactions. Again, the book, The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al Qaeda by Ali Soufan. But specifically in terms of your personal knowledge, just sticking with what you just said then, where you're presenting what you know personally, in 2010, you say there was a missed opportunity to get bin Laden because the official in charge of Guantanamo refused to support a deal made between you and a key detainee. And this,
right.
this is despite the endorsement of CIA and FBI officials. What in God's name happened there?
Well, you know, at the time we're looking for Osama bin Laden, right? And this is actually, it happened, I think, in 2002 or 2003, around that time period, we're looking for Osama bin Laden, we have no leads. And then we get a guy in Guantanamo who is very close to Osama bin Laden. He is related to bin Laden's Yemeni wife. We knew that bin Laden's Yemeni wife at the time is with bin Laden. And we thought, you know, if he want to make a phone call to check on his wife, let's follow up what happens after that. You know, who the family of the wife is going to call, you know what I mean? And how it's, you know, and maybe that will lead us to where the, you know, where bin Laden is. That was a lead. I mean, we didn't know 100% it's going to lead us. We didn't even know 50% if it's going to lead us. But there's no other leads at the time towards Osama bin Laden. And now, as we know now, after we killed bin Laden finally, 10 years after, that the Yemeni wife was with bin Laden. So was there a possibility that that can lead us to bin Laden, that can lead us to someone who can lead us to bin Laden? That possibility will still be there. Unfortunately, at the time, even when we lacked any evidence any specific actionable intelligence that might lead us to anyone who might lead us to bin Laden, they decided to drop the ball and not follow the lead.
But what you say in your book is, though, that in 2002, an important al-Qaeda terrorist held in Guantanamo was released without even notifying his interrogators. What happened there?
Well, this person is really high up in the group, even to the point that many members of al-Qaeda think that he's a member of the Shura Council at the time. He was very close with Osama bin Laden. He has been with Osama bin Laden since Afghanistan, since the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And he went with him to Sudan, and then he went back with him, flew back with him to Afghanistan when bin Laden left Sudan back to Afghanistan. After the 1998 embassy bombings, bin Laden appointed him to be his the head of his, you know, kind of equivalent of our secret service. It's called the Guards, you know, the security detachment. He was the head of that that unit under bin Laden, very close to him. This guy was the highest-ranking Qaeda guy we had in our custody. And overnight, he was taken away. We had no idea where he was taken. He just disappeared. And later on, I was reading a newspaper, an Arabic newspaper, Al-Hayati newspaper, actually, an Arabic paper published in London. And in it, I read that a judge in Morocco released him. And they couldn't find enough evidence to prosecute him. And then I knew that basically he was rendered to a different country, and that country just simply released him.
I guess you never were able to find out on whose order was this person released and why. I mean, that's the part that's extraordinary, given that we held people that we shouldn't have been holding, and in by holding them we radicalized them, but somebody that was actually what they refer to as a high-value target was let go is kind of incomprehensible. I mean, it reminds me of what Glenn Carr was saying recently, the CIA interrogator, that he was interrogating somebody that he knew was innocent, and yet the more he protested to the Bush administration, and specifically it was coming from Cheney, the more they insisted on more enhanced interrogation methods.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that resulted to false information anyway. And you're right. I mean, there is a guy that we knew for sure 100%. He is high-level Qaeda operative, and he leaves the island. And people that we knew they are nothing, they stayed in the island. That's something that I don't have an answer for, but I think it's a very, very good question.
So Ali Safwan, in terms of some of the sort of touchstones in our concern about terrorism and those that would attack us, we've had a series of attempts, the latest being the Times Square. Fellow referred sometimes as the jockstrap bomber. Then you had the guy with the shoes. And then, of course, prior to that, there was Padilla, who they made a big fuss about. But mm-hmm. but you're saying that the real story about Padilla is wasn't told, and that the Attorney General totally misrepresented him, and you were told not to contradict the information because the President Bush was making a speech.
Yeah, this is in 06. You know, we've been told the whole thing about the contradiction. We've been told in 06 that Padilla, we identified him as a dirty bomber. And again, this is allegation. You know, Padilla doesn't know anything about a dirty bomb. I mean, you know, he has the intent, but definitely he doesn't have the capability in any way, shape, or form, nor the knowledge on how to do it. But he was a bad guy, and he was a member of the terrorist group, and he was being sent back home to conduct terrorist attacks. So what the president said in 06, and after that it has been repeated again and again, that enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding led us to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11. It also led us to identify Jose Padilla as a dirty bomber, plus a few other terrorist plots that were disrupted allegedly because waterboarding and because Abu Zubaydah provided that information after he was waterboarded. Well, this is not true. And the facts are basically the facts very opposite. Actually, these kind of techniques prove that Abu Zubaydah was talking before waterboarding, because waterboarding did not start until August of 2002. August of 2002. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was identified as the mastermind of 9/11 in April of 2002. Padilla was identified, according to the court documents today, in April of 2002. So How can a person identified in April of 2002, arrested in May of 2002, how come that happened as a result of waterboarding, a technique that did not start until August of 2002? It doesn't make sense. So basically what happened after the OLC memos has been released and after this false narrative was being, you know, promoted by members of the former administration.
Sure. OLC, for the benefit of the audience, is the Office of Legal Counsel. That's the John Yoo memo, right?
Yeah, it's Bradbury, Yoo, right. And Steve, and Judge Bybee, and so forth.
Sure, sure.
All these memos, right. A combination of, right. You know, a few of them,
yeah.
Together.
Sorry to interrupt you, but go ahead.
Yeah, so basically, you know, and what I testified about in the Senate, I testified that, you know, this information is not accurate. You know, we did not know about PDEA. We did not know about KSM because of waterboarding. Actually, we knew about the month before waterboarding was even applied. And my statement to the Senate on Abu Zubaydah and on the alleged efficacy of these techniques is the only statement and remain until today to be the only statement under oath. And it's actually the fact, because I was there when we knew about KSM. I was there when we knew about PDEA. I was there when we knew about the alleged apartment complex threat that we were told that resulted of waterboarding. I was there when we were told about the Brooklyn Bridge. I was there when we were told about all these things, and we were not using waterboarding whatsoever.
So why do you think that it's been so difficult for the American people to understand how what a terrible misstep, if that's putting it mildly, torture has been, both in terms of its effectiveness, but also the enormous damage it's done to the reputation of the United States. And surely it has an impact in terms of foreign policy, because look at the Assad clan in Syria murdering their own
sure.
people. All they have to do, or Mugabe in Zimbabwe, or Gaddafi, the whole pantheon of these bad guys out there.
Sure. Well, I think the very first thing, you know, the question is, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques, the whole 12 steps of them, as appalling as they are to people in the West, to people in the United States, they are nothing compared to what happens in Syrian jails or Egyptian jails or jails around the Middle East. You know, this is like the welcoming party before the even interrogation starts. And this is one of the problems that I have with their efficacy, because basically, you're talking about, you know, going down on a route where you're going to hit a glass ceiling. The glass ceiling is, you know, the last step, which is waterboarding. And the person is going to keep repeating it again and again and again because there is no other step. And then the detainee will call your bluff, and then the detainee becomes in control, not you in control. So this is one of the issue that with the problem. The problem with why people did not understand it is people lived in fear for a long period of time, as you know, and people fear the unknown, and people were told a narrative that hasn't been challenged for a long period of time. It hasn't been challenged because the challenge was classified, and until now, even though a lot of these things has been in public domain, has been declassified by government documents, you see some of the portions of my book that has been redacted to protect that false narrative out there, to protect the false narrative that if enhanced interrogation techniques work. You know, I think the challenge of these techniques start to happen, and you have people like Glenn Call, you have people like myself, you have other people who are going out and saying, look, you know what, this is not what happened. Let us tell you what happened. Let us tell you how this program was very ineffective. And I think people, when they are fearful and they were told that, you know, you dunk somebody a couple of times in the water and then they're going to talk, you know, they say, well, you know, we're fine with it, you know, if it keeps us safe. You know, we were sold that fake concept of ticking bomb, which basically doesn't exist in real world. And even if it exists, enhanced interrogation techniques, as were set up by the Office of Legal Counsel, is not the answer of the ticking bomb theory. Waterboarding comes towards the end of these techniques. And, you know, from the beginning to the end, to reach waterboarding, sleep deprivation alone is more than a week. So in a more than a week, you don't have a ticking bomb theory now. The building already blew up, you know. So these techniques are not effective And it's not only me who's saying that. I gave you all the evidence where, you know, everything that you've been told was resulted from enhanced interrogation techniques. I'm telling you, based on firsthand experience, I was there, I witnessed it, and it was not because of waterboarding. But also from the CIA IG. Look at the CIA IG report. The CIA IG evaluated the CIA program. And when it came to the enhanced interrogation technique portion of that program, it said that, you know, it's very hard to evaluate, and even evaluating it is not without any concerns. And the CIA talks about, the CIA Inspector General talks about the same arguments that you're making. The short-term effect and the long-term effect, strategic effect on the United States and on the reputation of the CIA if they participated in that program. And also, the CIA IG, you know, reviewed all the alleged plots that were disrupted because of VIT. And they came to a conclusion, and this is in the CIA Inspector General report, that after reviewing all these plots, they could not verify that any of these plots, these alleged plots that were disrupted because of waterboarding and enhanced interrogation techniques, were imminent. So there is the CIA itself saying, no imminent attack can be verified, or they cannot verify any imminent attack, that was disrupted or stopped because of enhanced interrogation techniques. So I think we need to push back on the efficacy issue, because it is because of their effectiveness. Personally, I'm against them. And I know with asymmetrical warfare, with the nature of the threat of Al-Qaeda, with, you know, the whole issue about appearing as hypocrites around the world, that will have not only short-term harms, but long-term negative implication on the United States' reputation and strategy. But why even evaluating all these things if the techniques themselves never saved lives in the first place? So I think more and more now we're hoping that people will come out like Glenn Carr, like other, and discuss these kind of things. More people, hopefully, after my book, they can read the CIA Inspector General, they can read the Department of Justice Inspector General, they can read the Office of Professional Responsibility on the Office of the Legal Counsel. And all the truth is hidden in plain sight. You know, and don't follow, you know, what politicians are trying to say, what bureaucrats who are invested in the program are trying to say, because these guys are not telling the facts and not telling the truth. The truth speaks of itself.
Well, Ali Safon, again, the author of The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, since you're now chief executive officer of the Safon Group and you're doing risk analysis and consulting in the Middle East in particular, since you're an Arabic speaker, obviously. Let's finish up with a perspective on what you're currently doing in terms of what you just said, you know, the negative effects of the Bush-Cheney era's use of torture in terms of our reputation in that part of the world. The ground is shifting there dramatically with the Arab Spring. It's had paradoxically, it would seem that now our traditional foreign policy of realpolitik, where we act according to our so-called interests and not necessarily according to our ideals, no longer serves us. In fact, it's our ideals that are our best weapon, surely, in terms of winning the support of the people who are braving the streets. I mean, you have to credit these young people in Syria in particular facing lethal military weaponry at the hands of a ruthless dictatorship.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw the same thing with millions of people going to Tahrir Square and talking about freedoms and about free elections and about freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. These are all American ideals. We saw the same thing in Tunisia. We see the same thing going on in Syria, as you mentioned, with people fighting against a very ruthless, security apparatus by the Assad regime. So, I mean, you're right. Our ideals are phenomenal ideals, and everybody around the world wants freedom. Everybody wants, these basic rights, and people are fighting for it around the Arab world. And that needs to be part of our strategy in defeating Al-Qaeda. Tactically, we have been doing a good job in beating them, in kind of weakening their structure. But strategically, we didn't even touch on that. We didn't even touch about the ideology, about the narrative that makes this group the way it is, the counterculture that created for themselves within the Muslim world and within the Arab culture. And I think what you mentioned is totally correct. We need to develop a strategic counter-narrative, approach in dealing with these issues. And our strategy and our laws and our values need to be in sync. And if they were not in sync, unfortunately, that's going to fire back on us. I mean, Sun Tzu said long time ago, if you know your enemy and know yourself, you will win 100 times in 100 battles. Unfortunately, we didn't take the time to study the nature of our enemy. And in the last 10 years, I hate to say that we forget about who we are as people. And that's why 400 Qaeda operatives on the eve of 9/11 lasted in a war longer than World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Ali Soufan.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Soufan, who's a former FBI special agent who served on the front lines against Al-Qaeda and gained an international reputation as a top counterterrorism operative and interrogator. He's the author of the new book, The Black Banners, the inside story of 9/11 and the war against Al-Qaeda. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not we are drifting into a recession or a global depression.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, who serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and is a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, he was Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here.
And you have just been meeting with senior IMF officials and clearly there have been several intense days with world leaders gathered for the annual meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And given that the Dow had its worst week since October 2008 on Friday, clearly there's concerns about the markets on Monday. Is this drift going to continue?
Well, I think it's the question there is it's all up to the Germans. The German government right now is like an insurance agency that wrote a policy on the rest of Europe, and now that there's been an accident, particularly in Greece, they're not sure they want to pay. So everybody's testing the Germans as to whether they will come in and modify these structures that govern the financial system of Europe, fortify particularly Spain and Italy, and put things back on track. Absent that, you could see an unwinding of the European common market and an unwinding of the currency system called the euro and a calamity probably on par with Lehman Brothers in 2008.
Well, George Soros has been warning that the German people think they have a choice here, and clearly the German politicians are responding to an angry populace. Surely what's really happening here is the German people will be bailing out German banks, won't they?
Well, I think that bailing out the German banks is at the German banks and to some degree Spanish banks is at the core of the vulnerability, and possibly the French banks as well. When people default on sovereign government debt, a lot of that sovereign government debt is held by banks within the European system. And so at some level, the countries are deciding whether they'd rather blow up the system and then bail out the banks, or would they rather bail out the countries, which would then obviate the need to bail out the banks.
So we have any number of warnings from the World Bank and from the IMF, and then we have the U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner saying the threat of cascading default, bank runs, and catastrophic risk must be taken off the table. This couldn't be plainer, surely.
Well, one of the things that's happened recently is that the European banks have been funding themselves in what's called the shadow banking market of the United States. They've been borrowing dollars in New York from money market funds. And just like in 2008, when there were defaults on Lehman paper, some of the money market funds, which do not have deposit insurance, so-called broke the buck, meaning they had to give you back 97 cents on the dollar. What's happened recently is that the American money market funds have essentially stopped being willing to lend to European banks as their banking enterprises kind of grind down because they can't fund themselves. They're calling back loans or not extending loans, both to each other and to many of the emerging markets. European banks provide about $3.5 trillion of the $5 trillion dollars of bank lending worldwide, according to the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements. And so they are the biggest channel of funds to the emerging markets, and that's drying up.
But isn't there an irony here, Robert Johnson, that the emerging markets like China and Brazil are actually helping bail out the Europeans?
Well, they haven't agreed to that yet, but certainly the vitality of their two economies helps people export to those two countries. And they are contemplating making financial contributions in return for enlarged voting share and political power within the International Monetary Fund.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Robert Johnson, who's executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. So there is this, I feel like we're in this peculiar kind of maroon in a kind of twilight zone between dire economic realities and dismal political possibilities. And I think that applies both to Europe and to the United States. And this is the European crisis has been going on for some time. Clearly, they've all, you know, the politicians are slow and the markets are fast. So, I guess the question on most people's mind is that are they going to drop the ball here? I mean, are we going to slip into to quote Soros again? He said that we really are in a recession. Well, if they don't get their act together soon, we're going to be in a depression, surely.
Well, I think that's the danger, because depressions usually come from banking calamities. The 1930s were really became a world in depression, to quote Charles Kindleberger's famous book, when the German banking crisis and Austrian banking crisis happened in 1931. We had a pretty narrow escape in 2008, but I would say we're just in a continuation of that crisis, and to the extent that these authorities from the 17 European countries don't get their act together, they can tip us over the edge. At some level, like Lehman transmitted around the world, something emanating from Europe and Greece can propagate right into the United States and to other parts of Asia and Latin America.
So presumably, Robert Johnson, having just met with the top IMF officials, and they're meeting in Washington, and the world leaders are gathering, of course, at the UN. So there's no shortage of meetings going on here. What's the level of recognition of the dire nature of this? Not to mention, of course, that the IMF has said that we're in a dangerous phase.
Well, I would say Christine Lagarde, the new managing director of the IMF, did a very good job at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City Jackson Hole Conference saying banks in Europe need more capital. Number two, she's done a very good job of talking about the slowdown and the need to resist austerity, and she set the tone for these meetings. But Tim Geithner is worried and speaking very publicly, our Treasury Secretary in the United States, And at a panel I attended this morning, Jean-Claude Trichet, Ben Bernanke, the Shirakawa, the governor of the Bank of Japan, and the deputy prime minister from Singapore, all spoke very lucidly about their concerns. So I don't think this is something that is surprising to any of these officials, but the tractability of a solution that requires 17 parliaments to ratify a solution while the financial markets and financial speculators are bearing down on the process, this is a very complicated thing. But it's not for failure to recognize the danger.
So, Robert Johnson, what's going to happen then with the 440 billion euro fund, the so-called EFSF? The United States apparently have urged Europe to leverage that fund, possibly with the support of the European Central Bank. Is that going to happen, and will that staunch the bleeding?
I think they're talking about leveraging that fund by using that capital to guarantee banks or to guarantee the European Central Bank, the ECB, against losses to the extent that they buy more of these bonds and try to stabilize these markets and therefore stabilize the bank balance sheets. Paul Volcker has talked openly in the Washington this week about hoping that other countries like the United States and China will actually commit money to this stabilization fund to make sure, as he says, it's a big enough gun that it scares people and never has to be used.
So the European Central Bank, the ECB, it's basically set up to pursue low inflation. Can it, reinvent itself, on a dime?
Probably not, and it's very controversial, of course, within Germany, which has an experience in the 20s of hyperinflation, because they don't want, essentially, their central bank to do fiscal policy. But everybody realizes right now that either they have to very quickly vote to enlarge the scale of the European financial mechanism, the EFSF, or they have to use leverage, because unless they, what you might say, create a countervailing pressure vis-a-vis the bond markets, the speculative episode will be kind of a self-fulfilling crisis, and it's well underway. This is one of those episodes of ounce of prevention would have been a pound of cure. 2 years ago, the Europeans could have put this fire out for very little money. They've allowed it to rage. They've avoided restructuring, and now it's, as you mentioned, threatening to propagate all over the world and could tip us all down into recession again when our economies are all very fragile.
So clearly, Robert Johnson, this has enormous political implications, and we are in a political year with an even more one coming up. The president has to be recognizing that no president's been elected with the unemployment figures that he currently has re-elected since FDR was. So he's got quite a millstone around his neck. If this goes the way that many are warning, and we don't know what will happen on Monday, do we, with the markets? They certainly tanked on Friday. What are the political? Is there anything left in the political toolbox?
I think that the political toolbox is in stalemate in the United States after the debt ceiling and some of the problems between the Republicans and Democrats. We do not see any clear path for using fiscal policy in the United States to offset the weakness that we've seen. And if there's more weakness coming because of a European calamity, how we get our Congress to basically save us from crisis when they're more interested in austerity and liquidating the public sector just on ideological grounds, I think it's very troubling.
So do you think we could have this extraordinarily embarrassing and ironic situation where the global economy is going to hell in a handbasket and the United States government is shut down because of the ideologues in the House who are insisting on cutting any monies out of a bill that's meant to compensate people for the recent hurricanes because they don't like, improving the gas mileage of cars that are being built in Detroit. They've taken $1.8 billion out. We could be facing a government shutdown here in the United States while the world is facing this financial crisis.
I would say that prospect of a government shutdown is less dangerous. I think they'll work that out. I think the big danger is that we do not respond vigorously in the event that a European crisis unfolds, and I think that's very problematic.
Well, you should take that call, and I thank you for joining us, Robert Johnson. Hello? Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project at the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, he was Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting, and you can also contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back tomorrow and throughout the week, Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.